Case number 08-1144 et al. Sierra Club et al. Petitioners v. Environmental Protection Agency. Ms. Desay for the petitioners, Mr. Ray for the respondent, Mr. Llewellyn for the interveners.
Ms. Desai, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Cushy Desai on behalf of Petitioner Sierra Club and Louisiana Environmental Action Network. In this case, EPA has failed to comply with the law in numerous ways by issuing a gasification exclusion that allows refineries to manage hazardous waste without otherwise mandatory protective regulations. I'll start with EPA's failure to provide adequate notice and comment opportunity as required by the Administrative Procedure Act, because that procedural defect alone warrants vacature of the exclusion without requiring the court to reach other issues. This is a case in which EPA proposed one specific rule and finalized one that was very different, one that the public did not have notice of and one that could not have been anticipated. It's important to remember that there was only one proposed rule in this case. It was issued in 2002, and it was an exclusion for gasification of petroleum refinery hazardous waste that included a definition and specific conditions that EPA indicated were crucial for ensuring that the gasification process was a legitimate fuel manufacturing process as opposed to unlawful hazardous waste disposal, specifically incineration. Based on the proposal, the public had no reason to believe that EPA was considering eliminating any of the conditions. One particular example is instructive. The condition for synthesis gas, which is the product of the gasification system, to have met EPA's own prescribed synthesis gas specifications, which it set forth in a separate rulemaking, which served as the purpose of limiting toxic constituents that were actually contained in the synthesis gas. EPA said that the syngas specification in this rulemaking would limit volatile metals in the gas, and EPA didn't indicate anywhere that that the compliance with that syngas could become unnecessary. Quite to the contrary, EPA actually invited comment on whether it should revise those specifications to make them more protective. And that's what commenters did. In fact, Sierra Club submitted comments to that very effect, arguing that those syngas protections in the original syngas specification rulemaking were not sufficiently protective. Yet, in an entirely unexpected move, EPA issued the final exclusion without the syngas limits, and in fact, without any limits at all. And EPA's excuse for doing so was that suddenly, because the exclusion was limited to use at refineries only, that syngas limits weren't necessary. Of course, that's not what EPA said in the proposed rulemaking, and EPA used that same excuse for abandoning several other conditions as well. Again, the public had no reason to believe that limiting the exclusion to refineries would make any difference whatsoever as to whether any of the conditions would apply. In fact, EPA said the exact opposite in the beginning of the proposed rule at JA 106 when it explained that gasification systems operate in exactly the same manner wherever, whether they're used to process materials into fuels at a petroleum refinery or somewhere else entirely. In the final exclusion, EPA also adopted a completely different legal rationale, which it claimed excused the agency from requiring some of those conditions. The syngas condition in particular was proposed and finalized pursuant to EPA's authority under 3004Q of the statute. Suddenly, in the final rule, EPA claimed that it was an inappropriate use of RCRA to regulate a fuel product manufactured at petroleum refineries. Again, EPA provided no basis for petitioners to expect that it would offer this type of different legal rationale and abandon those conditions. In fact, EPA itself concedes that the final exclusion is not actually based at all on the 2002 proposal. Again, the only proposed rulemaking present in this case. Instead, EPA claims that the exclusion was based on a 1998 notice of data availability that was issued a decade earlier in an entirely separate rulemaking. There are two very critical problems with this. First, the 1998 notice of data availability was not a proposed rule. It wasn't called a proposed rule. It didn't offer any kind of legal rationale. It didn't even offer the agency's own view on gasification. Instead, it was exactly what it purported to be in that rulemaking. It was a notice to the public that EPA had received information and data on a different type of process, gasification, and invited comment on that process. And that's what petitioners and others, Petitioner Sierra Club and ETC, commented on. It was that data and information alone and no more. In fact, those comments revealed that there was confusion about what the purpose of the NOTA actually was, whether EPA was inviting comment on some kind of proposal, and if it was, it needed to go through adequate notice and comment procedure.
Is there any precedent from this court addressing the role of NOTA in providing notice and comment? Have we ever held that a NOTA is at least relevant to whether sufficient notice was provided?
For rulemaking, Your Honor, mm-hmm. I'm not aware of any such case.
Either way, good or bad.
I'm not aware, but I think in this case, whether or not there are cases in which a NOTA provided sufficient comment opportunity, this was not one of them because, again, it was very clear as to what EPA wanted comment on. It said that the agency is reopening the comment period only for the limited purpose of obtaining information and views on the new data and information described in this document. And that was a document contained, again, in an entirely separate rulemaking. So EPA, the public had no basis to understand if EPA was proposing an actual rulemaking from that. And in any case, the fact that that NOTA came through a different rulemaking obviously cannot serve as sufficient notice and comment for an exclusion issued in this rulemaking. That EPA received comments there doesn't change the fact that what EPA issued in this case was an entirely different type of exclusion.
How would your comments or input have been different had you been given more particularized notice?
Sure, Your Honor. One example would be the one that I mentioned earlier on the syngas specification. Because of the way that EPA presented the syngas limitation, commenters assumed that EPA recognized that it was necessary to have some limits on the hazardous constituents contained in gas. They had no basis to think that EPA might change course entirely and issue one that had no limits. And so had there been adequate notice and comment opportunity, the public would have commented to the effect that having a syngas exclusion without any limits at all on toxins would be extremely dangerous for the public interest. Furthermore, the other problem with EPA's reliance on the NOTA is the fact that the 2002 proposal, again, the only proposal in this rulemaking, doesn't give any notice to the public that the NOTA was still up for consideration. Even a cursory review of that 2002 proposal reveals that fact. The NOTA is discussed only in three very discrete locations in that proposal, and that's only to remind the public that at one time in the past a NOTA existed and to describe in the most general way some of the data that EPA received on that. The only way that petitioners could have known that EPA was considering the NOTA at that time would have been, as this court has held inappropriate, to divine the agency's unspoken thoughts on the NOTA. And this is, as we've noted in our briefs, this is very similar to a number of cases in which EPA ends up taking the position that's essentially the complete opposite of the one that it proposed. In a last-ditch effort in EPA's briefs, they argue that the 1998 proposal, the 1998 NOTA, in the separate rulemaking issued 10 years earlier, provided sufficient comment opportunity for the final exclusion at issue today. EPA cannot bootstrap notice from comment, which is a crucial problem with that argument, and that NOTA was issued in an entirely different rulemaking and could not have informed the public as to what the issues were here.
Talk about their reading of 6924Q is not applying because, as they say, this stuff is not hazardous waste because it's not discarded.
Sure. Your Honor, that interpretation of 3004Q is completely contrary to what 3004Q in its plainest term says. 3004Q applies to any listed hazardous waste, listed or identified hazardous waste, and that is used as a fuel. Congress was very clear in making that a broad statement. Congress was reacting to a very specific problem that occurred under EPA's pre-existing regulations, which allowed for burning of hazardous waste to be done without RCRA regulation, without because EPA was able to call it a process that didn't involve discard.
They say there's no burning here, or not de minimis burning, not sufficient burning to trigger that concern.
Well, 3004Q, first of all, also applies to producing a fuel from hazardous waste, and in any case, there is certainly burning of the syngas, which 3004Q also covers. It covers burning of any hazardous waste-derived fuel, and that's exactly what this does. So the gasification process actually involves both provisions of 3004Q. So the fact that it doesn't apply defeats the exact meaning of the statute on its plainest terms and cannot be reconciled with what Congress, the actual problem that Congress sought to resolve in this. If 3004Q meant that EPA still had discretion to determine whether something was discarded, then 3004Q would essentially serve no purpose, because that's exactly the place that EPA was in before 3004Q was issued. And to make its intent even clearer, Congress enacted very specific exemptions in the statute, and one of those is for a petroleum process, the production of pet coke. Congress obviously did not mean to say that EPA retained the discretion to create more exclusions, and that exclusion on its face serves as proof that 3004Q applies to the use of all hazardous waste.
What do you say about American Mining Congress?
We say that it doesn't apply in this case, Your Honor. American Mining Congress dealt with the issue of discard, which is a completely different issue than the application of 3004Q. The court there was considering EPA's interpretation of discard as to a variety of different processes. And its mention of 3004Q was in response to EPA's use of that provision as evidence from Congress that it meant for EPA to be able to regulate hazardous waste that are used and used for fuel under the definition of discard. However, the court did not actually rely on that 3004Q in any sense in making its determination, because that wasn't the issue.
So is your view that 6924Q essentially displaces as a statutory matter any regulatory definition of discard?
No, Your Honor.
Waste, what constitutes a hazardous waste? Or
no.
How does it fit into that whole statutory framework?
It provides an additional way by which a hazardous waste becomes a hazardous waste. It doesn't affect in any way. It certainly doesn't undermine the definition of solid waste and EPA's ability to call other processes discard or not. It provides a very explicit provision in which hazardous waste that are used to produce or burned as a fuel are, by definition, discarded, essentially. And that's what the AMC court held. It said that Congress deemed these wastes that are used for this particular process hazardous, and therefore within EPA RCRA's reach. And again, that was to correct a very, very important problem that Congress had identified. If we accept EPA's reading.
They say it's not within RCRA's reach. It's that it's subject to whatever regulations and they deem appropriate.
I'm sorry?
They say it's not that it means we have to apply the full panoply of RCRA to this type of material. They say whatever regulations they deem necessary, as may be necessary to protect human health and environment.
That's right. And that's what 3004Q, that is what it says. Well, but EPA's...
I hate to... I don't hate pitmits. Sometimes I like pitmits. You continually cite here and in your brief 3004Q. You provide us with a statutory appendix that doesn't have the numbers 3004Q in it anymore.
Oh, I'm
your
sorry,
statutory
Your Honor.
Appendix has and should have 6924Q.
I apologize.
The Act
for
has
that.
Been enacted. It is now codified. Now, we are trying to find the statute you give us in the brief. I haven't seen anybody do this in years. It used to be common, but you're giving a citation to an act that isn't out there anymore.
I apologize.
It's now a code. It's now codified. The government quite rightly gives us the citation to the code in their brief. If we're trying to work from your statutory opinion and your brief, they don't match. Now, that may not be a problem for you because you work in environmental law all the time. We work in several dozen statutory schemes. We don't know the Act citation. Why in the world an attorney would put together a brief that uses the Act citation and file it at the same time as a statutory opinion that uses the code citation is beyond me. And I'm speaking to the attorneys in the next case, and I presume are in the court because the petitioners there did exactly the same thing. Please don't do that. We don't want to have to enact a new local rule that's going to send your briefs back to you, but you're going to find them coming back one of these days if you keep persisting in doing that.
Sure, Your Honor. I sincerely apologize for that.
And one more small thing. The standing.
Sure.
Do you contend that the ECT, whatever, ETC, whatever the thing is, has standing?
Who has standing?
ETC.
On the standing issue, our position is that the court need not reach ETC standing on the constitutional avoidance doctrine.
Would it make any difference to anything if we did and struck them out?
It would not. They join all of the same arguments that we've raised in this case.
And they didn't seek any different relief.
I'm sorry?
Their petition doesn't seek any different form of relief.
No.
All the issues are raised by people who may not concededly have standing, but have certainly made total arguments.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. I see that my time is running out. There are no further questions. Thank you.
Mr. Ray?
Good morning, Your Honors. Norman Ray from the Department of Justice, representing the Environmental Protection Agency. With me at council table is Alan Carpian from EPA's Office of General Counsel. In this rule at issue here, EPA added gasification to the list of recognized petroleum processes into which oil-bearing hazardous secondary materials can be recycled. Because such recycling is part of an ongoing industrial process, in accordance with this court's decision in AMC1, American Mining Congress, the secondary materials are not discarded and thus are not solid or hazardous waste. Petitioners do not dispute that gasification units at petroleum refineries are process units, or that the insertion of oil-bearing hazardous secondary materials into such units is part of an ongoing production process. That should end the case right here, because this court in AMC1.
Before we end it on the merits, will you address the notice?
Sure, Your Honor. Your Honor, the court, petitioners had adequate notice of everything the agency intended to do. This rulemaking has to be considered as partly in context, Your Honor. In response to the court's decision in American Mining Congress, which EPA went back and promulgated a rule in which it determined that certain production units at petroleum refineries were production processes, and therefore oil-bearing secondary materials inserted into those specific processes were not solid waste, were not discarded. That provision was never challenged. Other portions of that rule were. That was back in the late 90s. At the same time, EPA published a notice of data availability in which we said, in which the agency said, you know, we are also considering adding to this list of processes gasification, and we'd like comment on that. The comments on that rule, both by Petitioner Environmental Technology Council and by the Lone Star chapter of Petitioner Sierra Club, clearly understood that EPA was proposing to make that change. They referred to it as a proposal.
When did that comment period close?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
When did that comment period close?
It closed sometime. It's in our brief, Your Honor, the dates. I don't remember off the top of my head, but it closed after the...
In the 1990s
the
still?
Early rule. Yes, Your Honor. Closed after the rule, shortly after the rule.
Before 2000.
Right. Not this rule. I mean, it was clearly it was proposed as part of an earlier rulemaking or in conjunction with an earlier rulemaking, although, you know, the timing with it was clearly indicated that it was sort of something APA was considering adding to the rule that it was promulgating to add the other types of units. Then in the 2002 proposal at issue in this case, EPA specifically referenced the earlier note in a lengthy footnote too early in the agreement, talked about that was the origin of the proposal, but in the proposal was proposing to expand the exclusion from the definition of solid waste to any gasification unit at any facility. and it proposed a variety of conditions that it said were necessary, given the broader exclusion, to distinguish between gasification units, or what was called a gasification unit, that would be used for waste disposal, and one that was actually an industrial unit.
I'll ask you what I asked the other side, and that is, what is your best authority for the notion that this NOTA can sort of tag team with the 2002 proposed rule?
Well, Your Honor, I don't have any specific,
together.
Right, I don't have any specific questions on the NOTA, but the
isn't that kind of odd that we don't have all this time? We've never ever had a case where a NOTA has been relevant to determine whether notice and comment was satisfied. Which way does that cut?
I don't know that there hasn't been a case, Your Honor, but I have not.
I don't recall ever seeing a NOTA reference. Really, in any context. I've only been here about 27 years.
Well, they are used in a variety of contexts, sometimes to provide additional
notice. It doesn't mean that they're relevant to anything that comes to us.
Well, Your Honor, I think it's relevant in this.
As far as providing notice, I have to say I don't recall any case.
I couldn't well,
even discuss
it. Well, it would certainly be unusual. But in this case, Your Honor, we don't have just the note. We have the proposal. And the proposed rule proposed a broad exemption and proposed certain conditions on that exemption. Certainly inherent in proposing that broad exemption, there is the possibility that EPA could promulgate a narrower exemption. And certainly in proposing conditions, there is the possibility that EPA would decide those conditions are not necessary. You know, Honor, and in fact, there were numerous comments on each of those conditions suggesting that they were, in fact, not necessary. Petitioners certainly should have envisioned that. And if they had arguments,
what language in the notice do you most rely on to put them on notice that you were going to say, never mind, we're just going to insert it over here in this list of ongoing processes?
Well, the fact that we specifically, in the footnote 2 in the notice
footnote
where we discussed
two.
The mm-hmm. NOTA, where we say that this was the origin of this process and that we're now considering a more broadly expanded
exemption. A much more regulated process.
Well,
is that all you've got is footnote 2? Footnote 2 referencing NOTA is your source of notice that you might throw everything out the window and then just put it in the list.
No, that's not what we suggested. We said the rulemaking had originated, you know, in this earlier rulemaking where EPA, in response to AMC1, the agency had promulgated a list of specific processes. And it had proposed in the NOTA, or suggested in the NOTA, that it would be appropriate, or it was taking comment on the question whether it was appropriate to add gasification to that list of processes. And then in reference and in discussing in note 2 and in discussing the NOTA, it pointed out that that was the original of this proposal and that this proposal was a continuation of that idea. And clearly, you know, if Your Honor, if we had promulgated, one way to think of this, Your Honor, is if we had promulgated the broad exemption but had decided that the conditions were not necessary, would there be a question of notice and comment? You know, clearly we had proposed a broad exemption. We proposed specific conditions, but if based on the comments we said, the agency had said, we're going to promulgate the broad exemption, but we don't think the conditions are necessary, clearly there would have been an opportunity to comment on whether those conditions were necessary. So why should there be a notice and comment problem where instead of promulgating the broad exemption without the conditions, we've promulgated a more narrow exemption without the conditions? The plaintiffs, the petitioners had adequate notice simply from the even if you ignore the NOTA. The 2002 notice by itself gave petitioners adequate notice. They knew that the gasification industry, the petroleum industry, other industries were going to comment and say, these conditions aren't necessary. You know, these are industrial processes. We don't think you have jurisdiction. But in any event, you know, the nature of these processes means that the conditions are not necessary. They, in fact, filed those comments. Petitioners have been in this business a long time. They're quite savvy. They knew those comments were going to come in. And they had the opportunity at that point to comment and say, no, you need those conditions. There is nothing in the final rule that they did not have an opportunity to comment on. And that is the bottom line test. Did they have notice and an opportunity to comment on the issues before the agency? And they clearly did. They're clearly raised in the 2002 proposal. And the NOTA functions primarily to put the 2002 proposal in context, to say where it came from and that it's, you know, that at least part of what's contemplated in the 2003.
So your position is anytime you give notice of something bigger, you can do something smaller.
Right. And the court has certainly said, for instance, that one thing that's inherent in proposing to do something is to not do it. And certainly a corollary of that has to be that if you propose to do something large, you can do something small. Or at least you have noticed that you might do something smaller if this is what you've asked for comment on. So the 2002, there is nothing in what the agency finally did that they did not have an opportunity to comment on. They thought those conditions were essential. They had the opportunity. They filed extensive comments on gasification.
What would be to have stopped you from just giving a notice saying, hey, we're thinking of doing regulations that might in some form exempt this from regulation. Let us know what you think. And then we can do anything smaller than that. Would that be sufficient notice and comment?
Well, Your Honor, obviously it has to be considered on a fact-specific basis. But certainly here, the agency specified very specific conditions, given a specific rationale, took comment on them, and then ultimately decided not to go forward with its larger exemption, but promulgated a subset of that, which was simply to add this to the list of units that it has determined are process units, which they do not, you know, the bottom line that the agency determined here, which is that these are process units and are therefore excluded under AMC1, they don't contest.
Can I ask you something about the 6924Q argument? And your argument is that as long as it's not discarded, that it's used here in this ongoing process, it's not hazardous waste within the meaning of 6924Q. That's my interesting position. And what I don't quite understand is the title of that section is Hazardous Waste Used as Fuel.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so it presupposes, Congress supposed that this was actually material that was going to be used for something, not discarded. And so how does your position not sort of empty the statute of meaning or empower you to empty the statute of meaning by saying as long as it's being used as fuel,
well,
it's not being discarded?
That's the argument EPA made in AMC1. And that's the argument this Court rejected in
AMC. No, you weren't talking about use as fuel. And you weren't
Your Honor.
As an analogy. It's not certainly what we ruled on.
No, Your Honor, that's actually not the case. The briefs, EPA's briefs in AMC1 said we want to regulate that 3004Q says hazardous waste. It gives the EPA the authority to regulate things used as fuel. And this Court rejected it. This Court clearly said 3004Q.
I think what it said pretty clearly is this isn't a 6924Q situation. That was dealing with this particular usage as fuel. You were involved in, you were dealing with a different one of your four exemptions under C in that statute.
No, Your Honor, in AMC1, we're talking about uses petroleum refineries, which are, and petroleum refineries, as the Court noted, made fuels. We were specific, the briefs in that case specifically addressed the applicability of 6924 to petroleum refineries because they were in the production of fuels. And that is exactly the argument the Court rejected in AMC1. This is AMC, the rule that this Court was reviewing in AMC1 did impose regulations on these materials when they were recycled at a petroleum refinery. And that's the rule this Court struck down in AMC1. And that's the rule that EPA, that decision is the one that EPA responded to when it created the exclusion for this that is now amended. You know, remember, you know, this rule today that we're talking about now simply amends an existing rule that provides for that specific materials that are inserted into a refinery process to make fuels are not solid waste and are not discarded. That is the holding in AMC1, that as long as a material is part of an ongoing process, because the basic jurisdictional requirement for something to be subject to 6924Q is that it be a hazardous waste. And the statutory definition of a hazardous waste requires that it be a solid waste. In order for it to be a solid waste, it has to be discarded. And what the Court held in AMC1 was that as long as a material is still in process, is part of a production process, it's not been discarded, it's not solid waste, therefore it can't be a hazardous waste, and therefore 6924 is inapplicable to it.
I'm not going to ask the presiding judge to direct additional briefing, but if we could have each of the parties address in a letter to the Court for the West Virginia versus EPA 362F3861 addresses the notice problem in reference to the number.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, could you repeat the site?
362 F. 3rd, 861. It's West Virginia versus EPA. An old man's memory refreshed by consulting Westlaw on the computer reminds me that I wrote an opinion concerning notice that did concern notice, so I don't think it requires additional briefing, but if we could just have like something equivalent to a 28-J letter.
Be happy to do that, Your Honor.
From each side addressing that. And by letter, we mean something short. I don't mean by writing a new brief.
Yes, Your Honor. I'd be happy to do that.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Llewellyn.
May it please the court. From the intervener's perspective, this case is truly deja vu all over again. At some point, stare decisis has got to kick in. In AMC 1, EPA argued that we can regulate oil-bearing hazardous secondary materials used to produce fuels at refineries because of the command of Section 6924Q. This court said, no, you cannot, because in-process secondary materials used in an ongoing production process are not discarded and therefore are not solid waste. Now, petitioners here say that EPA must regulate oil-bearing hazardous secondary materials used to produce fuels at refineries because of 6924Q. The problem with petitioner's case is quite obvious. If EPA cannot regulate these materials in spite of 6924Q, then there's no way that they must regulate them because of 6924Q. And I think there may be some confusion here that I should try to clear up. We're all talking about the same materials here. I use the term oil-bearing hazardous secondary materials because that's what industry calls them, and that's because of what EPA calls them, the longstanding exclusion at 40 CFR 261.4A12. In AMC 1, EPA called them hazardous wastes. This court called them in-process secondary materials. And now here, the petitioners call them hazardous wastes. But we're all talking about the same materials. We wouldn't have been in AMC 1, we wouldn't be here if the materials involved were not hazardous. Under EPA's definition of solid waste in 261.1B1, nothing comes into play at all in the definition of solid waste unless it's hazardous. So we were not talking about some different kind of materials in AMC 1. The materials we're talking about here, we're talking about the same materials going into the refining process. I'd like to address very briefly the APA issue that the court has spent a good bit of time on this morning. I think it's very clear, put aside the NOTA, that the 2002 proposed rule provided adequate notice of what EPA was going to do. And I would cite what we cited in our brief at page 29, is that at 67 Fed Reg 13685, that's at Joint Appendix page 101, EPA said that the purpose of the rulemaking was to put gasification of oil-bearing hazardous secondary materials on, quote, the same regulatory footing, i.e. excluded, as other secondary materials returned to the petroleum refining process, close quote. And that is exactly what EPA did in the final rule. I would also offer the court a citation from page 30 of our brief. Mr. Rave addressed the argument that a notice proposing an exclusion with some conditions reasonably encompasses the possibility that the final rule could have fewer conditions, more conditions, no conditions. And a case almost directly on point is Battery Recyclers 208 Fed 3rd 1047 at 1059, where a proposal to allow alternative treatment standards for remediated soils encompassed the possibility that the final rule would allow alternative treatment standards for all soils as proposed, or no soils, or only for some soils. And in my remaining time, I would like to touch on the standing question because I think it's important. There is a huge difference between cases like Battery Recycler 716 Fed 367, on which petitioners rely, and this case in terms of standing. In Battery Recyclers, the relevant activity for standing purposes was operation of a smelter. Well, here the relevant activity is not operation of a refinery. It is not even operation of a gasification unit, because gasification units can be and are used to gasify products such as petroleum coke or residual oil. So the relevant activity here for standing purposes is gasification of oil-bearing hazardous secondary materials, at a petroleum refinery to produce synthesis gas fuel. And petitioners have not shown a substantial likelihood that any particular relevant refinery, is engaging or will engage imminently in the relevant activity.
If we take that view of standing, will the whole regulatory act here escape review? I understand that's not enough to give standing, but it certainly can be considered, I think. But at what point would you say someone would have standing to challenge it?
To challenge it?
Yes.
Well, Your Honor, for example, the closest petitioners come is, I think, at declarations, page 40 of their brief. They offer the Port Valero Port Arthur refinery that supposedly is going to put a gasifier into operation this year. And they point out that petroleum coke is going to be used as the feed. Well, petroleum coke is not oil-bearing hazardous secondary material.
You seem to be going a long way from the question.
Well, I'm getting right to it, Your Honor.
We'll get there.
If a document such as that said that this refinery was going to gasify oil-bearing hazardous secondary materials, I don't think there'd be much argument. There has to be some, under this court's precedent, some showing of a substantial likelihood that a particular local actor is going to take advantage of the incentive provided by the
How would they have noticed? I'm sorry, go ahead.
We don't know that yet, whether they're going to or not. And I'm asking you, do they have to wait until they start using the process? Or what is it that would you say would make
sufficient
to come within our standing?
I think the petitioners have to show that they have someone who lives near a refinery that either is now or is in the very near future planning to gasify oil-bearing hazardous
We found industrial and interveners here coming in caring enough about the right to do so to make one wonder, well, if you weren't going to, why are you here?
Well, Your Honor,
why are you here if you're not going to do it?
It's a very good question. We'd like to preserve the opportunity, Your Honor.
Well, isn't it more than that? I mean, to establish your Article III standing, you have to show that you are able and ready to do this, and as you said in your own papers, you have a very substantial interest in having this opportunity. Isn't their injury directly correlated to your interest in doing it?
No, and I think the API, the court in API 2 addressed this question, because in API 2, where the issue was use of oil-bearing hazardous secondary materials to quench coke, there was a plain incentive for industry to take advantage of this. And plainly, API and its members had lobbied, commented, they went to court to defend the rule. Same thing applied.
I mean, there we found there was, the hell, there was thing in API, too, didn't we?
No, Your Honor, you did not. No. That case, Your Honor, is almost identical.
Well, except that case, I think the language of the opinion was, quote, no averments.
Okay.
And here,
right. And the court,
and
Your Honor,
here we
could
certainly
not
have a variance.
I'm getting my API mixed up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
It has three initials and four initials.
Your Honor, the term of ver was used by the court. The term of ver we often think of as meaning allege, but the old legal meaning is actually prove, and one of the dictionary definitions is prove. The court cannot have meant allege, because as we know from Defenders of Wildlife and many of this court's opinions, when you get to the briefing stage, for the motion for summary judgment stage, allegations are no longer enough.
Because I'm just trying, look, you're here at the same summary judgment stage they are.
Yes.
And I'm trying to understand why your quote, and these are your words, very substantial interest, does not equate with their very, you have a very substantial interest in being able to do it, and they have a very substantial interest in you not being able to do it. And the two seem to go hand in hand to me. And API 2 said nothing about that.
Well, our standing was not at issue in that case, interestingly enough, because probably the same argument could have been.
I'm not saying yours. I'm just saying the same reason you have it. They have the same interest in stopping you all from doing what you want to do.
Your Honor, we probably don't have the strongest case for standing that I've
Well, I'm assuming you're here on a good faith belief that you have Article III standing. You have a very substantial interest. You're already enabled to invoke this regulation, and they're in the same boat.
Well, someone in industry.
It's not amici. You're supposed to have standing, too.
Absolutely. Someone in industry probably will use this rule someday. But the question, according to API 2, is can the petitioner show that they have someone who is affected by a particular refinery that is particularly likely to either be doing it now or to be doing
it? This is just a practical question. How would they know when you're about to or you start? One of your members starts doing this.
You know, one of the observations that this court made in a footnote in API 2 was there's no indication that the petition has ever asked. Mm-hmm. Okay, they ask.
They have to come asking at every company there in the neighborhood. I mean, people will have to come knocking on your door. Or do you have to provide any public notice before you start?
Not in this case, Your Honor.
No, how would they have notice? Really, you ask if someone writes? Maybe you would. Maybe you told me all your members, if someone wrote a letter in, would say, "Yeah, we're starting on Tuesday."
I don't know, Your Honor. I don't know what the response is.
We were told that everybody but ETC has standing, and ETC doesn't have standing. Would our ruling on ETC make any difference to anything?
Your Honor, I think it would help the court maintain its rules, because the rules do require that when you...
I appreciate your assistance, but as a practical matter, we'll be deciding the same issues with or without ETC, right?
That's right. There would be no substantive difference. That's right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Does Mr. Desai have any time? All right. Why don't you take 2 minutes?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll address standing very briefly, since it's fresh in the court's mind. This case is nothing like the API 2 standing decision. There, as Your Honor pointed out, petitioners hadn't made specific averments as to facilities that were likely to claim these exclusions. In this case, our members live next to and work next to and recreate next to all of the refineries that EPA specifically listed in this rulemaking, all five, that are both refineries that generate the excluded hazardous waste and have gasification units on site or have plans for gasification units on site. Interveners nor EPA have contested either of those points. Council referred to the Port Arthur Valero facility. We obtained that information from intervener's own information, and our petitioner there is very concerned about the likelihood of being exposed to increased harms. Again, it's not the same case that created a problem in API 2.
Can you respond to their reading of AMC, American Mining Congress?
Sure, Your Honor. I think it's both EPA and interveners have referenced the briefs that were issued in that case. We don't have those briefs. We just have the case that's in front of us. And I think the court couldn't have been clearer there that the issue in front of it and the issue that it addressed was discard, not the provision that we're arguing over today. If there's any question about that, we can look to subsequent cases. One in particular is the API case from 1990, where there it said, confirmed that the issue in AMC was whether EPA could, under RCRA, treat as solid waste materials that are recycled as discard. And there is also one other case, the Horsehead case, that was also issued involving similar provisions, in which the court there confirmed also that the issue before the court, I will read directly, the holding of AMC is not dispositive in that case. AMC involved an altogether different facet of waste disposal governed by a different statutory section, the solid waste provision, not 3004Q, which is at issue in this case. I would like to very briefly talk about the notice issue. There is no basis for EPA's statement that the 2002 proposal provided adequate notice of the NOTA. This court has held in the EIP case, which is referenced in our briefs 4425F3922, that just a mere mention of another approach is not sufficient. If notice is to mean anything, it should inform reasonably the public as to what issues are available for comment.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
The letter discussing West Virginia versus EPA, if the parties could submit that in the next 5 days.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you.